Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Joy of joys, we have cause to celebrate. We're joined by my friend Andrea Picciotti-Bear, who is a legal analyst for EWTN News, as well as the director of the Conscience Project. Again, you can follow her work, conscience-project.org. And the reason why I'm saying we have cause for celebration is because the Supreme Court soundly affirmed the question and attack on religious freedom in the case involving Wisconsin Catholic Charities. The resounding 9-0 unanimous Supreme Court victory last week for Catholic Charities Bureau of Wisconsin is a much-needed cementing, a reminder, if you will, and certainly a continued narrative forward that what unites us as a nation is in fact our commitment to safeguard crucial civil rights enshrined not just constitutionally, but in certain explicit ways by means of the Bill of Rights. Now, I want to make clear, the founders didn't have as their intent the need to enshrine explicitly every single right owed to the human person, which unfortunately has presented many of the modern struggles that we have right now, because all of our founders, to a man, appealed to Judeo-Christian principles and the foundational framework of natural law and therefore objective morality. And so they presumed that the Constitution was penned in such a manner that would allow for the continued upholding of the dignity of the human person and objective morality in the social sphere. And so, in its application, different factions of government, different parties in government, can disagree in terms of application. But the unifying principles, crucial civil rights, come from greater endowed, divinely given rights from the Creator to man. And so, we can talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But fundamentally, we're talking about the dignity and the right to worship and the right to express one's faith. And so that's what this victory is going to be about. We'll talk with Andrea about this. And then finally, we will speak with Father Paul Mariani about the rise of the church in a post-Mao China. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, June 11th. It's the Feast of St. Barnabas, and today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Police in cities across the country are bracing for more anti-ICE protests today. An overnight curfew was put in place in a one-square-mile area of downtown Los Angeles, where most of the violence and vandalism has taken place since the protests began last Friday. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott ordered the state's National Guard to be deployed to cities. Protests have broken out in New York and Chicago, where thousands demonstrated downtown on Tuesday, as well as in Denver and in Washington, D.C. The U.S. is reportedly preparing to evacuate its Iraqi embassy. Reuters reports the decision is due to heightened security concerns in the region. The outlet added their sources did not specify which security concerns led to the decision. This comes as President Trump has threatened to strike Iran if nuclear program talks with the country failed. In an interview Wednesday, Trump said he's grown less confident that Iran would agree to stop enriching uranium. Elon Musk is offering an olive branch to President Trump. Musk now says some of the posts he made last week about Trump went too far. The SpaceX billionaire got in a war of words with the president on social media last week, which started with his opposition to Trump's massive spending bill and culminated with him claiming that Trump was mentioned in the Epstein files. And Beach Boys founder Brian Wilson is dead at the age of 82. He's considered one of the most innovative songwriters of the 20th century. Wilson also had his own solo career and toured regularly since 1999. No further details about his death were provided. From the Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The Supreme Court issued a resounding 9-0 victory last week for Catholic Charities Bureau of Wisconsin. This is a much-needed reminder of what unites us as a nation, our commitment to safeguard crucial civil rights like religious freedom. An added bonus has been the opportunity to catechize on Catholic social teaching across the nation. We discuss this with Andrea Picciotti-Brea, who is legal analyst for EWTN News and director of the Conscience Project. You can follow her work at conscience-project.org. Andrea, happy news. Great to see you. Great to speak with you.
Marcus, it is happy news indeed. I love when we get to talk about victories together.
Let me ask you, did you do a little happy dance when it went exactly where we thought it was going to go?
Well, I'm always doing a little happy dance, but I did a very big happy dance after the court released its decision last Thursday, and it was it's wonderful. It's rare that the Supreme Court has a unanimous decision, and I like unity for all sorts of good reasons, and this is one of those.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good reminder that there are some things that are just easy things to see and for the court to decide. And I think it's a wonderful move for the church, especially, to continue to do their work, and be able to get the benefits that are providing for, religious institutions across the board.
Now, I'm very excited about this, but I don't want to get ahead of myself because some of our listeners might have forgotten or might not even be aware of exactly what we're talking about. So for their benefit, let's just provide some context as to what the case is about and what has recently happened.
Yes, it's a good reminder. Not every person is a Supreme Court nerd like I am. So I love the little nudge in the right direction, Marcus. You know, so this is in the state of Wisconsin, there is an unemployment insurance program that all employers need to pay into. And that's consistent with a federal unemployment tax law. And but they do allow for religious entities to be exempted from that pay in if they have their own system to provide for people who are leaving their employ. That's the case for the Catholic Church in Wisconsin. And Catholic Charities Bureau is part of the Diocese of Superior. They've been in operation for, I guess, almost 100 years. I mean, it's amazing what they've done to respond to the needs of the vulnerable in their community. They applied for this exemption in 2016, and they were denied the exemption from both the state agency in charge and the Wisconsin Supreme Court, saying that they weren't, quote-unquote, operated primarily for a religious purpose, which is such a, like, head fake. You're like, wait, what?
Right.
How is an entity, Catholic Church, not operated primarily for religious? And part of it has to deal with the kind of corporate structure of Catholic Charities, that they are an independent corporate entity for, just for governance. But for governance, they actually are governed by the bishop.
Mm-hmm.
And the bishop decides who's going to be on their board, and it's part of the social ministry of the church. So it was very important to press this idea that religious purposes can look very secular to the untrained eye and have a religious purpose. And, what was very indicative, and we spoke before about this case, is if people become less churched and they see the world responding in very philanthropic ways, they misunderstand true Christian charity. And so the Supreme Court said that the test to exclude Catholic Charities, and the reason being that they didn't proselytize, they didn't limit the services or the gifts that were given to people if they, only Catholics could receive soup at the soup kitchen, that sort of thing, that it was open, consistent with Catholic teaching, to anyone in need. That wasn't for the state to decide that it wasn't a religious entity. The state was taking a very narrow look, saying if it doesn't look like worship, It's not religious. And the Supreme Court very, very clearly said you're discriminating among religions, because those religions that do have that kind of condition on charity, that it's only for co-religionists, would be able to be exempted from the state program. But those that are like Catholic charities that provided for anyone in need would not get the benefit. And that was a discriminatory religion among religions. And so it's really wonderful to see that. The other thing that was great, though, Marcus, is one of my favorite justices, Justice Clarence Thomas, really kind of drilled down on the importance of religious autonomy, the autonomy of churches as protected under the First Amendment, that it's kind of the combination of the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause to keep government out of the internal decision making of a church. So when it comes to whether we're going to incorporate our social ministry separately or it's going to be part of the church incorporation under the law, it's a decision, and the government can't question that.
Yeah. Now, I'm no legal expert by any stretch of the imagination, but as you and I have been talking, I kept bringing up the fact that this seems on the surface to be a very clear First Amendment violation act of First Amendment religious clauses. And based on Justice Sonia Sotomayor's declaration of the court's opinion, that's exactly where the Supreme Court landed.
Yeah, you know, and that's also really interesting. You know, Justice Sotomayor is kind of considered part of the liberal or progressive wing of the court. And the fact that she is the author for the court in this case is really significant, because it shows that issues of religious freedom, issues of church autonomy, aren't partisan issues. These aren't issues that you can say people on the left agree with and people on the right disagree with, or vice versa. This is an American issue. This is a constitutional issue. And I thought it was brilliant when figuring out who's going to write the majority opinion. It's up to the Chief Justice to assign opinions. And I thought it was just brilliant that Chief Justice John Roberts assigned it, but it wasn't in that typically pro-religious wing of the court, which happens to be the more conservative wing, but instead someone who's kind of considered a progressive.
And the majority, the opinion of the courts here, however, just tell us about where they landed as it pertains to those tricky words that for some reason the state Supreme Court didn't seem to grasp, which was religious purposes. So the Supreme Court, now federal Supreme Court, didn't define it. But if you could comment on that a little bit.
You know, that's interesting. There is this kind of, I'd like to ignore concurring opinion by Justice Brown Jackson, and she typically votes with Justice Sotomayor, and she gave perspective on the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, which has a similar exemption for religious organizations. She got into her perspective on that. I particularly disagree with that perspective. It wasn't relevant to resolving the case. But she did get into the more finite issues related to religious purpose, whereas the majority opinion and Justice Thomas really just said, look, the way that the Wisconsin was analyzing things was just discriminatory. And so we're going to declare this unconstitutional on that grounds. I think that it is very indicative, though, that there weren't more people disagreeing with what she was saying. And so I think it's very, very promising. It doesn't mean that this is the end of the story. And the fact that Justice Brown Jackson went out of her way to basically offer an analysis that might exclude Catholic charities in the future in other states is a little troubling. But for now, I think we should be doing that little victory dance.
I agree. And it's also a very fundamental validation of the biblical reality of Christianity, that we are not confined to the sheer work of proselytization. That's a crucial component, to be sure. But all of our works of charity called for by Christ in Matthew 25 is to extend to all, not just Catholics.
Absolutely. Amen, Marcus.
Andrea, always a joy and a joyous piece of news for us to celebrate. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you. Have a great one.
You too. My guest has been Andrea Picciotti-Bear. We've been talking about how the Supreme Court soundly affirmed religious freedom in the Wisconsin Catholic Charities case. And we are blessed to be able to celebrate this. The fight still goes on. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Hi, this is Ed Bahura with Sylvan Learning Centers. This is one of our many five-star Google reviews.
I would like to take the time to thank all of the staff at Sylvan for helping my daughter achieve her goal of attending the University of Michigan Ann Arbor with a full scholarship. My daughter has been able to maintain all A's in math and increased her SAT score by 200 points as a result of attending Sylvan.
To learn more, call 1-800-EDUCATE or visit sylvanlearning.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Ron Finn here, inviting you to join Dave Basheris, Pat Ody Murray, and me for Morning Offering, the Catholic way to start your day.
We welcome some very special guests each day, including Teresa Tamio, Andrew Reinhardt, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and Matthew Archbold. Plus, my chat with Pat, talking with Catholic experts from all over.
Plus, we're having fun along the way, so you can start your day with a smile. Morning Offering, weekday mornings at 8, here on the Ave Maria Radio family of stations.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Following the Cultural Revolution in China, the Catholic Church, the local Catholic Church in China, but also the global Catholic Church's response to Christianity in China, underwent complex journeys. Focusing on Shanghai, Father Mariani delves into the tensions between the state-sanctioned Catholic Church and the underground community that remained loyal to the Vatican and the Church's magisterium. And he uses newly accessible Chinese sources to illuminate this intricate and convoluted narrative. Father Paul Mariani is a Jesuit priest and Edmund Campion Professor of History at Santa Clara University. He's also the author of Church Militant, Bishop Kung, and the book we are talking about today, China's Church Divided, Bishop Louis Jin and the Post-Mao Catholic Revival. Father, thank you for making the time. How are you?
Very good, Doctor. Good to hear you and good to be on the interview.
It's a real honor to connect with you. I want to say, as someone who grew up in Asia and was schooled in Chinese Taiwanese, I was schooled in a Chinese Taiwanese school, the historicity and the background of your text is crucial, because I think very few people are fully aware of the very particular intricate plight of being a Christian in especially communist China, but now post-Mao China. So for the sake of our listeners, if you could provide a bit of a historical context as to where they've come from since the Cultural Revolution and where they are now.
Exactly right. So as you know, having that experience in Asia, that sometimes it's hard to explain sometimes to an outside audience, but people are very sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
I have found people interested in China, and it'd be a bit like taking, United States history, even in the last 60 or 7 years,
yeah.
Like, where do you begin?
Yep.
But I think in broad strokes, I took in this book, China's Church Divided, which I have a copy here in my hand, but it's really for major release in July. I decided to take a more narrative approach. So I have these scholarly sources. I try to do a deeper history, but I found that a narrative approach often works with a scholarly audience, because sometimes people are reading outside of their field, but it also works with to hit the kind of, you know, the regular average Catholic, mm-hmm. what are they interested in? You know, they're interested in the history. And I think to get into a lot of jargon, you put up a brick wall. So I did about as accessible as I could. And let me say that there were two books. I did mm-hmm. a book on the 1950s, the Church Militant. Yep. And that was when there was a direct, very clear clash between the Catholic Church and the party, which was kind of newly ascended, had just beaten the nationalists in a civil war. And then I see, and that was about 14 years ago. And I'd always felt I could do a sequel. What happened mm-hmm. when China reopened after the Cultural Revolution? Because in many ways, people hear the Cultural Revolution, that was a period of kind of high drama, and the churches were attacked. But even in the 1950s, things were not always easy for Catholic and Protestant churches within China, because there was a real struggle with the state, of which the Cultural Revolution was sort of the pinnacle. And then in the 1980s, the Chinese government decided to change direction mm-hmm. a bit and be a little bit more friendly with churches, in some cases helping them, regain properties. And so I've documented that in my current book, but it was very clear that the state still wanted control and they still wanted a state church. So what I try to do in the book is show that there was sort of it was kind of black and white, but in this period there was more gray in the middle that some people could maybe go along. So the Vatican made efforts to contact China, even Pope John Paul II mm-hmm. made efforts. So I think it's Church Militant is much more kind of black and white, where we see Pope Pius XII say, you know, you're not really a good Catholic if you go along with the government, that you have to resist, that what they're doing is unjust and is against religious liberties. And it was a very clear kind of clash. And then you have the kind of the dark ages there, but we're not really sure what was happening. But what was happening was they were kind of erasing religion from China, and very little news got out in the 60s and 70s. And then suddenly things open again in 78, 79, 80, and people are shocked to find that despite taking a terrible battering, the churches, the Christians, Catholics still exist.
Yep.
And they're coming back to life. And so the story here with this China's church divided is, you know, what do you do if you're a priest or a lay person and the government is giving you some freedoms,
right?
But they have to be taken in context. They're not going to give you complete freedom. So what were the gray areas? What were the possibilities? What do they say about politics? It's the art of the possible, right? The mm-hmm. art of the possible. So trying to find a way to negotiate in the future. So, and unfortunately, what we got was sort of a divided church, that there was, the government was still very much committed to this state church idea. And then the underground said, we will not go along with this. We've been, kind of tricked in the past. So they go their own way. And then I think for some people, there was, there were gray areas. Maybe they could work out some freedoms. And so what I document in the book is some areas where the Vatican, finds people they can work with, and other areas where they kind of have to draw a line.
Yeah.
So I focus specifically on Shanghai just because I'm more familiar with it, and also it did, I was able to find some pretty good documentation, talk to people, and I think sometimes just telling the story of one place makes it more understandable for people.
And you certainly achieved that. And I must admit, as a proud citizen of the United States, I also have to realize that in a first world, First Amendment nation like the United States, we take for granted the sheer amount of religious liberty that allows us to do what we do or not do. Meanwhile, when you look at what the CCP achieved in the establishment of the Chinese Catholic Patriotic Association in 57, and the willful attack on the church, you know, their assets and privileges and even public presence was ostensibly removed, the restoration came slow, and even then it's been limited. I'd like to invite you as a priest and as a professor to, for the sake of our listeners again, to comment on the real socio-religious but also socio-political struggle that Catholics in China face that we don't have an inkling to here.
Right. So I think one thing I often find is people, you know, they like, and it makes sense. We're kind of schooled in histories of the martyrs mm-hmm. in the Roman Empire. So oftentimes when people approach China, they want the story about, you know, a lone individual who resisted, you know, temptation, resisted what the state was asking mm-hmm. and was swiftly martyred. And that's the end of the story. But what I found, especially in the first book, Church Militant, was how much of a corporate effort it was, how much that the church worked in tandem together, that yes, there were lone individuals who did impressive things for their faith, but there was also a cloud of witnesses, sung and unsung heroes, and that it went from the top down. And it divided families at times, but it also showed that the church there in Shanghai in the 1950s was very attuned to what the Pope was saying in Rome about how much they could go along with the government, how much they had to draw red lines. So the corporate witness was very powerful. And so, you know, it was impressive to see that the government knew, for example, the different pressure points. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make as good copy, you know, of say a lone individual standing up and being executed. Yeah. But what happened was the first thing that they did was, you know, to take nationalize schools, take over the Catholic schools, take over the curriculum. And I'm sure, some people had to suffer a kind of white martyrdom, in the 1850s.
My guest is Father Paul Mariani, Jesuit priest, Edmund Campion Professor of History at Santa Clara University. We are talking about the church divided in China, surviving the Cultural Revolution in a post-Mao China, and the Catholic revival that's happening there. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Feature.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town, where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
On the next Epiphany.
Hi, Vanessa Denha-Garmo here. John Mansoor will tell us all about Stride for Seminarians event coming up later this summer and why it's important. We'll also highlight the National Association of Catholic Nurses Conference coming up at Madonna University in Livonia.
Epiphany, weekdays at noon. And be sure to catch past episodes in our archive at AveMariaRadio.net.
Blessed Carlo Acutis is quoted as saying, "Continuously ask your guardian angel for help. Your guardian angel has to become your best friend." We all have traveling companions, our guardian angels walking with us through life. How often are you communicating with your angel? Jesus said, "I send you an angel before you to protect you, to accompany you along the path so that you do not make mistakes." According to the tradition of the Catholic Church, each of us has a guardian angel who protects us and helps make us aware of things around us. In his Angelus in 2021, Pope Francis noted that oftentimes we have that feeling that I should do this, or this is not right, or be careful. That's the voice of our guardian angel. We don't walk alone. Not listening to our guardian angel's advice, however, the Pope says, is like telling him to go away. It's dangerous to chase away our traveling companion. This has been a Christ Center communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peace. I'm talking with Father Paul Mariani, a Jesuit priest, professor of history, and the author of China's Church Divided. Father, I want to pick up where we left off by also addressing, like you mentioned, that it's easy for us to desire, especially as Catholics with the Catholic historical heritage, for those very clear, definitive stories of martyrdom, one man contra mundum, and laying down their life, and those are laudable, wondrous, exemplary witnesses for the faith. The situation in China, replete with political stress and strife, has called for some level of nuance, one could say, but really pastoral prudence. And we see this in people like Bishop Jin, for example, and his accepting a position with the CCPA and yet trying to be a pastor and a shepherd to those who remain loyal to the magisterium.
Exactly, exactly. So, fast forward to the 1980s, now we see that, people had really suffered for their faith. They had seen it kind of the churches taken over, that there was almost no public manifestation of religion in China in the 60s. That is a well-documented fact, that the churches were taken away. They could not publicly state that they were Catholics or any religion. So it was a very, very difficult period. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, in the late 70s, I think the government, they write documents, and they say that by 1982, they're aware of what they call the religious question, that, religion just doesn't disappear because the state wants it to disappear. Yeah. And that it is a long-term, protracted thing. So if it makes any sense, they kind of did reverse psychology, and they say, well, we're good Marxists. We believe that China, religion will disappear in China, but it's not going to happen so quickly. So that in the meantime, we found that strong administrative fiats deciding that, okay, religion is going to disappear, that will backfire. And in fact, the only thing it'll do, it will kind of unify people against us. So if we're going to govern China well, we have to kind of lay off religious believers a bit. And in fact, we have to help them. Now, mm-hmm. we're going to try to give away as little as possible, but we should train a clergy. We should, return church properties. We should give some, freedom of religion or freedom, yes, a freedom of what they call freedom of religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of a tongue twister, but so they did permit this, and to their credit, this is where some of the religious revival. Now, I think that they were surprised that how quickly things developed, that there was a greater need for churches than they were willing to admit, and that we see at this time a growth of Catholicism, we see a growth of evangelical Christianity, we see kind of there's a scarcity of churches and pastors. So the government has to provide these things, kind of if you break it, you have to fix it, right? So there were some Catholics say, absolutely not, we're not going to go along with the government. But they did try to control the seminaries and such.
Right.
But on the same token, you can imagine, and I've met them at the time, there were
young seminarians who come from old Catholic families and want to give to the church. And they have a bit of a dilemma because if they go completely underground, that the infrastructure is not there. They don't have the books, the libraries. Now, yes, there are lone heroic individuals who are mentored by priests, and they're able to make something of a go of it. But others decide to join what they call, you know, the state seminary. And then maybe after the fact, they would try to visit an underground bishop and say, hey, you know, I've been consecrated a priest or ordained a priest with the so-called Patriotic Church. And what do we do? And usually that underground bishop would try to make things right. So these are some of the moral dilemmas people had, that the state was showing some good faith, but it wasn't complete religious freedom like we see, you know, in the West. So they made decisions. And I think the Vatican, in a sense, I remember meeting one Jesuit, and in some ways the Vatican's response was a bit divided itself.
Yeah.
They would go to one office and they would say, do everything you can to connect with the so-called Patriotic Church and make friends and make connections. And another maybe dicastery or group in Rome would say something like, you know, stay away. They're not in communion with Rome. And I think in the end, what happened under John Paul and under Pope Benedict, because the lay people, they have the right to know who their bishop is, right? I mean, I don't know if that's exactly in canon law, but they have the right to know. And if it's confused, it doesn't help the normal functioning of the church. So the Vatican is slowly reconciling with bishop by bishop on a case-by-case basis, to the point that by 2007, when Pope Benedict wrote his letter, he even says in black and white in the letter that the great majority of Chinese bishops have been reconciled with Rome. Now, later, some people might say maybe they were too hasty or that some of the choices were not great, but to the point where we are today, where almost all bishops in China are reconciled with Rome, but then China keeps going ahead and naming more bishops, and then the Pope is kind of forced into a situation where he's presented with a fait accompli. We'll see where it goes now, but in some ways some issues are resolved, but still there are some thorny issues that continue in time.
How much of a role do you think the directives document, or the special directives document as you call it, in 1978 from the Vatican played in at least facilitating a reunification with the Vatican and better relationships between the CCP and the Vatican?
Right, exactly. That was a very special document, and I've seen it, and I got a copy of it in 1978, and it may have been true also for some of the churches in Eastern Europe. But basically, the Vatican wrote a small, at least for China, very thin document, which basically allowed extraordinary privileges for lay people in China and also for priests and bishops, that, you know, priests could do certain things that only a bishop could do. They could do it outside of their normal diocese because of the grave circumstances. So all of these, I think, I was thinking about this document even today. It gave broad and extraordinary permissions. And so we say, what is an underground church? It's kind of hard to get our mind around it. But that document, in a sense, gave a canonical basic, gave the green light from the Vatican, a canonical basis that a priest who got a hold of that small document could say, I can rest easy, my conscience is clear, I can witness this marriage, I can baptize these people, I can say a mass in the most stripped down version imaginable, like maybe just with the elements of bread and wine and the basic words, I can do this for a community. And so it really, I think, gave a strong canonical basis for an underground church. And then I think by 2007, when Pope Benedict wrote that letter to China, he revoked some of those special privileges, because you could see what could happen, right? And the other extraordinary thing I found in the book, A China's Church Divided, was apparently there was a document that permitted even bishops to consecrate other bishops. Now, I think that might have gotten a little out of hand in some areas, but they did give permission. So you can see the Vatican really wanting that if it's in survival mode, they will give the tools to the church necessary for them to survive. As things got more set and normal, then the church could kind of, they didn't need those survival tools. But they, for sure, it is documented, they did give the church the green light for the underground church to continue to grow and also to have special privileges that they knew the situation. For example, in China, you know, we think it's just normal. A Sunday is the weekend, right?
Yep.
You don't work. No one works on Sunday. Well, I mean, in many cases, you know, officially government offices, banks and things are never open on Sunday. Well, in China, they could not honor that. So they gave permissions for the Catholics to survive.
My guest is Father Paul Mariani, and he's regaling us with the intriguing reality of the struggles of the divided church in China and the continued pastoral prudence necessary for the sacramental well-being of the faithful there. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Support Arbor Women Health in their mission offering pro-life care to women facing unexpected pregnancies. Join them for their 2025 Flourish fundraiser dinner Friday, June 13th at 5:30 p.m. at the St. John's Resort in Plymouth, including special video messages from Lila Rose and Sean Carney, and emceed by Dr. Marcus Peter. Visit arborwoman.com to purchase tickets or become a corporate sponsor today. That's arborwoman.com.
The Wine Palace in Livonia is a proud sponsor of Ave Maria Radio. The Wine Palace is a family-owned business for over 60 years where customers come in for a great service. The 9,000-square-foot store includes a humidor, specialty wine room, and a rare and collectible spirits room. We have the largest selection of spirits in the state at the most competitive prices. Ask for one of the brothers, Cliff or Kelly, and thank them for their strong support of Catholic Radio. Delivery is available. Please visit the Wine Palace at I-96 in Middlebelt or at winepalacemi.com.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them, so you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
This week on Christ is the Answer, Father John talks about how important it is to tell your story. God has touched all of our lives in different ways, appearing personally and uniquely to each of us. And that story of how the Lord moved in and through us is a great way to evangelize. Join us this week as Father John not only tells God's story in his own life, but he shows us how you too can share your story and be an instrument for evangelization. Tune in for Christ is the Answer, Monday through Fridays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
How can we, mere mortals that we are, call God our Father? The Catholic Catechism says we can do this because His Son, who became man, has revealed the Father to us, and because His Spirit makes Him known to us. When we pray to the Father, we are in communion with Him and with His Son, Jesus Christ. We come to know and recognize Him with an ever new sense of wonder. The first phrase of the Our Father is a blessing and adoration before it is a supplication. We can adore the Father because He has caused us to be reborn to His life by adopting us through baptism. He incorporates us into the body of His Christ. The free gift of adoption requires conversion on our part. Praying to Our Father should develop in us two fundamental dispositions. Number one, the desire to become like God by responding to His grace. Number two, a humble and trusting heart. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
My dad, sharp as a tack, but getting him out for a dentist trip got harder every year. When he moved to the senior residence where he lives now, Dr. Mansour's portable dental service was a godsend. Dr. Mansour comes to wherever the homebound patient may be, whether in a nursing facility or the comfort of home. All the services you'd expect in a dentist office brought straight to the patient's door. Call 586-873-5567. That's 586-873-5567 or portabledentalservices.com.
The Encounter School of Ministry is offering a power-packed four-day event, allowing you to experience a taste of the School of Ministry. The summer intensive offers foundational teaching in the spiritual gifts, including kingdom identity, healing, prophecy, and inner healing, all drawing from the richness of our Catholic heritage, and taught by Father Matthias Phelan, Patrick Rice, and more. The Encounter School of Ministry Main Campus Summer Intensive, evenings June 23rd to 26th at St. Patrick Parish in Brighton, Michigan. Visit EncounterCatholic.com to learn more. EncounterCatholic.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Fies. I'm speaking with Father Paul Mariani. He is a Jesuit priest, professor of history, author of China's Church Divided, Bishop Louis Chin and the Post-Mao Catholic Revival. So, Father, when we left off, you were just telling us about those very real social realities, you know, things like not being able to honor Sunday without special permissions to worship the Lord. Now, over and above the socio-political realities that we've been talking about, and I'm a student of history, so that kind of thing deeply intrigues me because I think it's necessary. You also highlight in your book the spiritual revivals that are happening. There's one story of that woman who was possessed and how between a priest and three faithful women and the presence of the Eucharist, they see revivals, and her exorcism took place. So if you could just share with us about the spiritual revival that's taking place in China.
Exactly. So what happens, I think of it almost like the greater the church was repressed or put down, when things opened up, it was almost like a jack-in-the-box. It's just all of that pent-up energy and excitement came forward. So what I document, I think, in chapter two of the book or so, was that as the government slowly relaxes some of the pressure it had put against religion, suddenly things are back where they were decades before. And so there was a pilgrimage site just outside of the city of Shanghai, and it's still there. It's called Our Lady of Shushan, and Shushan is just Shu Mountain, and it was an old Marian site. People go there like in the month of May. There were some very wealthy, very connected, very well-educated Shanghai Catholics, and there was also some very humble fisher folk that had lived within the region. So it was both and suddenly as the government kind of loosened strictures around Shu Mountain there, you know, it had been kind of locked up. People could only go there secretly. And suddenly people showed up because they thought that in March of 1980, word had spread that there was going to be some kind of manifestation of the Virgin Mary. So people flocked there. And almost miraculously, some of the old canals that had been filled in or had kind of, had not been able to be used, it had been raining and raining and raining. And so people could even access it, you know, by car, by bike, by bus, but also by boat. And thousands showed up in mid-March of 1980, which I think was quite a shock. And this is documented, and it's real. And people called it the Shushan miracle. So you went from this officially atheist state to suddenly thousands of people coming out of all directions to see possible Marian apparitions. And so people went to the top of the hill. And so the government, I think, realized that, you know, what are we going to do? This is kind of out of our control. So I think in remaining years, they tried to domesticate it, permit it, but kind of under more careful control. Mm-hmm. But for sure, you know, these were little, the mid-level church was kind of barred and closed. And there's 30 years of dust, you know, right. 25 years of dust. And suddenly people are breaking down the doors and going in and praying. And it was largely peaceful. So yes, there were definitely miracles, and there was also cases of that were documented of exorcisms.
Yeah.
This woman. So this is kind of something that was going on in China at the time that is really, really extraordinary, and all the more extraordinary because it came in a place that where religion, they said it was eradicated. Well, it wasn't eradicated.
Mm-hmm. In fact, not only was it not eradicated, it was very clear that the religious sentiment, you know, the kind of sensus fidelium of the people was alive and well and waiting to bust out, to burgeon out, so to speak. So from there, between the spiritual uprising, if you will, or revival, I should say, plus the ever-growing, but it seems like an increase in freedom at the socio-political level, we have seen the Chinese church continue to take steps towards where it is today, but we also continue to see anywhere from ostracization to even persecution. Jimmy Lai comes to mind, and so it's not as if religious freedom is a complete gospel in China.
Right. And, you know, as China, you know, one kind of a piece that I do in the book is the 1980s. And since then, you know, China's economy has now it's kind of been it's kind of old news in a sense. Mm-hmm. So the 1980s, still China is quite poor. It wants economic reforms. It realizes it has to get everybody on board in order to create these economic reforms, that it can't antagonize religious believers.
Yep.
So that, in a sense, that's been a great success story, that China's economy has kind of boomed. And now I think we're in a, once again, in a period of greater tightening, that, you know, the 80s and 90s were never great for China, but they were better, that there was a greater spirit of openness. And now I think that one of the church that has to be very cautious in the current era, because there is a greater tightening, but also there are unfortunately some of the same problems we see in North America and the West, of, you know, declining family sizes, of fewer people wanting to go into the seminary. So it seems that it wasn't quite a golden age. There was
There
was more freedom, but the seminary, for sure, it was full at that time. So I think that, you know, we in the West can learn a great deal about the great fidelity of the church in China, but in some ways China and Chinese Catholics can also learn something from us, that we are aware of secularism, we are aware of you know, consumerism, we are aware of these things. And so I think it's kind of an interesting thing we can learn from each other. You know, how have you handled this? How have you dealt with it? Has it made your faith life stronger? So one of the great things I saw was in researching this was people kept to basic Catholic devotional life, and it kept their families strong even in greater persecution. And so with greater consumerism, and, you know, did they take away the family rosary and end up watching TV? These are things that are documented in the book. So that is a cautionary tale as well, that sometimes it's just faithful, simple practices that keep the community going. And when they're lost, they're hard to regain. So I think this is a cautionary tale for China, but also for us as well. And we know that in the West, you know, we have our problems, but hopefully we're still somewhat faithful. But we could always do better, right? And where do we get those stories? Sometimes they're from China, and sometimes it's China looking to us. You know, how have you dealt with this or that situation?
Yep. And so you made a comment, Father, that I'd like to ask for your expert insight on, as an historian, but also as a priest. When you consider the historical reality of China and its economic standing in the pre-50s, you know, into the 50s, 60s, even the early 2000s, its economy was nowhere near as influential, one should say, at the global level as it is today. And therefore, the CCP today exercises a different kind of authority over the church in China. And are we seeing a renewed sense of suppression of religious freedom and an overt push for the CCPA to flourish?
Yes, I think that, you know, they know the power of religion, they know the power of faith.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that currently in the church in China today, well, number one, I think they will, you know, they have to be diplomatic, that in a certain sense, the church and the state are not completely at loggerheads, that I'm sure that people know that the Vatican is talking to China, But I also think that there's a level of maybe disappointment that, you know, what will they do moving forward into the future? That it's a very delicate situation. Prudence and diplomacy is called for. But it's also, I think you're right, there is a greater tightening, and they said that. So, for example, I think that in the past there might have been rules about, you know, no one under 18, unless maybe you were from a Catholic family, mm-hmm. really should be baptized. But now it seems that they're really enforcing some of those things. So it's a delicate position. But I think, like, for example, the last time I was in China was 2018. The church tries to make things look as normal as possible, right? To just kind of carry on, to go forward. So people would see things like, you know, open churches. It's just that it's kind of in a climate of caution.
Mm-hmm. And this climate of caution is accentuated, compounded, or even mitigated, we don't quite know yet, with that deal that Pope Francis's papacy made with the CCP. A lot of, like I mentioned, the details were not made privy to the public. Do you have any insight on that?
There's no particular insight because it's still secret. I mean,
yeah.
But we'll see what Pope Leo does, if he kind of goes cautiously forward, or what he does. So I think for both the church and also for the Chinese government, I hope, you know, better judgment will prevail, and they'll try to work on certain commonalities, because you it's hard to work with China and just completely ignore the government. That's been true even of European countries as well, that they have to come to terms with who is the proper government, but then they also have to find ways for, you know, survival and maybe even flourishing of the church. So I think that issue will be around for some time.
Father, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for making the time.
Yes, thank you so much, Doctor. Great to talk to you.
My guest, Father Paul Mariani, Jesuit priest Edmund Campion, professor of history at Santa Clara University. We've been talking about the reality of the church in China, how divided it is, and the role that the CCP has played in dividing that church. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.